The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division will come to order at 8:30. We have a few bills to hear today, and first up on the list is Representative Junkie, House File 2301. Representative Junkie, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 2301 is a recommendation from the Agriculture Finance Committee on the dollars that we would suggest be appropriated from the clean water monies in the following 2 years. I'll go through them very quickly. There's five listed on there, and well, we'll start from there. We kept the same number that was recommended by the governor, so we did not change that in the first under Section 2, 1.19. Those are the exact amounts first year and second year that were recommended by the governor and the department. Number one, you see those monies, they basically go to laboratory services and testing. If you're not aware, the Department of Agriculture does extensive well monitoring around the state for pesticides, and then they run them through their laboratory, and this money would basically go to for a number of things, particularly in the laboratory testing arena, to expand the scope of what they can test, to increase the volume. Right now they do about 900 tests a year. This would increase that by about 600 more tests a year that they could run on pesticides from the well monitoring. And basically also what they do is develop best practices in the laboratory for screening these chemicals, and they then advise other laboratories around the state. So we think it's real important money to expand that water pesticide monitoring program, particularly in the laboratory. Number two, again, this is goes along with number one, which was primary laboratory, but this is to actually increase the tests and the amount of samples that are taken, and primarily to increase the nitrate testing that goes on. And we know nitrate is one of those chemicals, both in public and private water sources, that is a problem area. And so this goes directly to that program to increase the nitrate testing in particular, but all water protection. A lot of this is municipal water supplies, Mr. Chair. Number three, this goes to, again, you can read it, it's technical assistance, research, pilot prize, etc. This is for impaired water research. This is already ongoing in the department. What this would do is increase what they're doing, increase the projects out there, increase the technical assistance available to people. One thing you see in the rider language there, this was a change from what the governor had recommended. We looked at, Representative Eakin brought a bill over, and I think you might have seen it here, for Board of Soil and Water Resources, and part of the G16 recommendations that weren't funded elsewhere. We looked at those, and ongoing in the department is also research on drainage and tiling and water quality improvements via those systems out there. And Bowser actually had a project they had asked money for. Since we also do that type of activity in the Department of Agriculture, have people working on drainage systems, we actually moved that request into the department in consultation with the Board of Soil and Water Resources. So they may do that over there within this division, and the department was okay with that when we did that rider language. On 211, number four, BMP program, Best Management Practices Loan Program. Again, what you see there is an ongoing program. This increases those loans amounts, those loan amounts out there, and actually involves a lot of, like I say, BMP, Best Managed Practices, not only in field settings, but a lot of these loans go to septic tanks and wastewater systems across our landscape. So a lot of small farms and smaller groups of people apply for this money. A lot of it goes to septic tanks and other things. We think it's important. Number five is another change that you see. It's kind of unique for the Ag Committee to be doing this, but we feel very strongly about it. Typically, Board of Soil and Water Resources are funded out of Representative Wagenius's committee and her recommendations. And she did, along with Representative Hansen, and the two bills that they're putting out, the Clean Water and the Omnibus bill that you'll see today on the floor, they do fund feedlot cost share money to Bowser. That's the money that goes to actually upgrade our feedlots. The focus in Representative Wagenius's bills were for riparian areas. If your feedlot actually adjoins a river or a lake, or, you know, those are critical, and we understand the need to prioritize those. And then Representative Hansen, I believe, added some for TMDL areas, again, a critical area in the state. However, we're still short of money in that program, and there are other areas besides those two areas where there's feedlots that are threatening water supply. If they drain into a ditch or they're next to a tile intake or those types of things. So what you see here is $1 million to help get that program more fully funded this year, because all these feedlots sit until we provide cost share. They are not required, they're required to register but not upgrade until these cost share dollars are available. So the quicker we can do that, the better. Needs to be priority there for high priority needs for local water management plans, et cetera. So they'll look at it, and where there's a direct impact to water supplies, that then will be prioritized in that list. And again, this still doesn't fully fund the program, but it gets us closer, and it's very critical. So the department or our committee thought, even though we're moving money from our department over to, frankly, a different account, that it was bipartisanly, we decided it was a critical. The other thing I glossed over, on back to the first page, this is just some rider language we'd ask you to put in your bill. We could have done it maybe earlier in our bill, but it's gone already. This basically also just adds some language that makes, again, a program we already have in the department, a loan program, makes eligible this variable rate fertilizer application machinery as qualifying for loans, low-interest loans, along with banks out there. And again, we already do this loan program. Representative Faust brought this. And basically what it is, we have precision equipment being made in Jackson, Minnesota right now. And that equipment basically takes soil types, takes yield data, all that's gleaned from combines and harvest equipment the year before. And then they correlate that with satellite data, GPS data, and other things. And literally foot by foot, yard by yard, parcel by parcel, fertilizer is applied precisely in the amounts needed. So you're not just applying 500 pounds per acre or 300 pounds per acre. You're actually directing it exactly where it's needed. So what this does, Madam Chair, and members, and why it's a good place to carry it in your bill, just as rider language for us, if you would, is it allows... when we do this type of thing, there's less opportunity for fertilizer runoff into our lakes and streams and ditches, because we're putting down precise amounts and hopefully less amount than what's needed. So our committee was really intrigued with this, and we hope we see more equipment developed like this. This is mainly equipment that's bought by our co-ops and others, so there's not a lot of these sold a year, but the more we can get sold, particularly in paired water areas and places that but even up in the Red River Valley, there's a need for this, even in that kind of uniform landscape. That's the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Junkie. Representative
Mr. Chair, sorry.
Quite all right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Junkie, I appreciate Section 5 coming in. I think that supplements the work we've done in the other committees. My question, and I like what you've done there in terms of identifying it, you know, to address high priority needs identified in local water plans, because that's new.
Right.
And the committee has struggled with how to separate substitution versus supplementing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at some of the other items, number four, number two, where there's existing programs, existing delivery mechanisms, and we've discussed with the parts and other funds that how do we assure that something's new? And I'm wondering if maybe, you know, as this process moves on, we look at some language that talks about additional or new or in priority areas or something that justifies the use of the Clean Water Fund, and that it's not a substitution for existing programs, but it's clearly something new.
And Mr. Chair, to a couple points, we believe that the majority of this is new. While it's in the department, for example, number two, that money would add 4.25 full-time equivalents to the department to enhance and expand what they're doing, not utilizing their existing, but to increase. And we did ask about those things. They went through point by point, the department. I don't know if they're here today. Some of them are, I see. So they can certainly come up and tell you in more detail. Most of this, number one, is going, a good share of that is going for a equipment purchase in the laboratory that expands that scope of testing. It's a unique piece of equipment, $535,000. So it is all new from what we can glean for the most part in here. It's additional duties, it's additional testing, it's additional monitoring, it's additional projects on the ground out there for the most part. These are people that won't be in the office down here, but they'll be around the state implementing these projects and monitoring the research that's going on out there.
Thank you. Representative Wagenia.
Thank you. I'm looking at line 2.1, and I was just checking my hearing here. Did you see if we're going to hire 4.25 more folks, is this just going to be to check municipal well water, or are individual wells going to be checked? And I have a follow-up.
It's monitoring mainly, a lot of it is community well work, municipal and community well work, but there is a lot that's done on individual basis too, but a lot of what they do is in community type wells, larger systems, where the nitrates tend to show up, particularly in our rural areas.
Representative Wagenia?
I know that the Department of Ag has done some individual well testing too, and so many of our folks drink from individual wells, not just municipal wells. When you're looking primarily at nitrates, Dakota County found that when they found nitrates in their well water, and Dakota is the only county that has done a really good check of their groundwater, they found pesticides at 100%. At what level, or is this money going to also be used to check for pesticides, and if you find nitrates?
And Madam Chair, I do have my lab folks here. Here comes Mr. Stoddard now, and he can speak in depth not only to the pesticide testing piece, which was number one, but also to the second piece there, and I think they'll be very enlightening for you.
Thank you, Representative Junkie. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Dan Stoddard. I'm Assistant Director in the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. Representative Wagenius, to answer your question, most of number two is to respond to nitrates in drinking water. And it's kind of an overarching response. It's more than just monitoring. There's a monitoring component, but it's also working with the Department of Health in source water protection areas. We've got a number of success stories where we have gone out with multiple agencies and evaluated ag practices and their contribution to nitrates that are causing exceedances. However, our resources really are fairly limited. The Department of Health is asking for some significant additional money to do source water protection, accelerate source water protection responses, and this is to work with them and basically cover a lot more towns, a lot more areas than we have the resources to do currently. There's also some other components in here. An important one, we think, is evaluating agricultural practices on a broad scale. We currently have a program with NAS, the National Agricultural Statistics Survey, where we do surveys of pesticide practices. We'd like to expand that to surveys of nitrogen practices. And that could be both within a particular area that's high risk, for example, within a source water protection area or with a county, and also regionally or statewide. And we think that's important to evaluate and get good information on actual practices, and we have that information then we can target our educational efforts and our promotional efforts and additional funding to specific practices that are needed in that area. So there's a number of different activities rolled into number two.
Representative Wiegand?
I'm just trying to figure out the outcomes here. So this is what you're trying, is what you're doing measuring or wellhead protection work?
This is Satter.
Sheriff, Senator Wiegand, there are a number of different outcomes that we would expect from this. The most important one is to reduce leaching of nitrates from nitrate, from nitrogen fertilizer into the groundwater. We also expect to promote and evaluate best management practices for groundwater, both in a local area and on a wider scale. We will be working with local communities and possibly counties to do pilot projects to evaluate different approaches for targeting DMP developments to protect groundwater. We're also going to increase monitoring and cooperation with other agencies using a low-cost method. Right now we're doing a pilot in southeast Minnesota with a number of agencies where we use nitrate meters to evaluate nitrate concentrations in private wells. So we would like to expand that in those areas that are of a concern. We also expect to have survey data on agricultural practices. And one important point that I overlooked is that we intend to revise and revisit the nitrogen fertilizer management plan. That's a plan that the state has to evaluate and outline a process to respond to elevated nitrates in groundwater that was last revised in 1991. And so we plan on having a public process to do that. So there will be a number of very specific outcomes.
Representative Junkie, I think Representative Wiegand has another question. I just wanted to verify. Did you say that there would be 4.25 FTE added in this number
Correct.
Two here? Okay, thank you. Representative Wiegand.
Well, my second question was, at what level, when you find nitrates, do you also test for pesticides and work to make sure that there is not pesticide runoff into the drinking water source?
This is Stoddard.
Chair Representative Wiegand, nitrates are much cheaper to analyze for than pesticides. So right now there is not an approach where we could do all the wells for both. It's much easier to use a field meter and evaluate nitrates. It's not perfect, but it's a very good indicator whether or not you're likely to have high nitrates. We are currently doing a pilot to evaluate a similar approach for atrazine, an immunoassay approach. It's more expensive than a nitrate meter, but it's much cheaper than a lab analysis. But for cost reasons, it's really not practical to do both on all wells.
Representative Wiegand?
Well, let me just share my concern, and that is that if you go out and test, particularly in a private well, test for nitrates and you say, well, if there's nobody who's really old or a little kid in the house, a baby in the house, you don't have to worry. And the implication is that your water is fine. But perhaps it's the pesticide that goes along with the nitrates that's the problem. But people are kind of falsely assured that, well, if the nitrate level is not going to hurt anybody in the house, everything is fine. And I have been worried about that false assurance, particularly with the children and the family.
Mr. Stoddard.
Chair Representative Wiegand. We do monitoring for groundwater for pesticides and nitrates and have for decades at this point. We are very concerned about that also. We published a brief study based on Dakota County data. We work closely with Dakota County that shows where there is a correlation between nitrates and pesticides and sampling. Generally speaking, shallow wells in vulnerable areas, aquifers near agricultural areas, are vulnerable to pesticides, and we do frequently find very low levels. They are nearly always below the drinking water standard, but their presence is a concern. We do have a pilot project going on right now in southeast Minnesota in cooperation with a number of counties where we're doing atrazine immunoassays on private wells where we're also doing nitrate tests to evaluate that exact concern, see whether or not there is a correlation, see what kind of numbers we're likely to find.
Members,
Representative Wiegand?
I share that concern because unfortunately, our health-based standards are not protective of children at this point. They're extremely old before we really understood impacts on children. So that's why I've been asking these questions.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Stoddard, remember that I helped work on that nitrogen fertilizer management plan, and if that was a baby in 1991, it'd be graduating from high school this year, so it's probably a time for it to be looked at and updated. My question is, how, kind of following up with what I asked Representative Duncan, so we have existing authority and responsibilities to the Groundwater Protection Act. We have plans that have been done. We have overall monitoring has gone up and down with general fund dollars over the years. How do we make sure that we're not, that this is additional work, or how do we clarify that this is new and it's not just funding programs that should be done under existing authority and statute?
Mr. Stoddard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we currently have a budget and staff for these kinds of activities, and all this would be additional work, additional budget and staff. We currently don't have enough people, we feel, and enough resources to really tackle this issue. It's a pretty significant issue. So we think there is a very real need to increase this effort. But just based on our budget, it's going to be really clear that this is an increase beyond our current spending.
Representative Hansen?
And then these would be two-year unclassified positions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think our intent would be to hire permanently with the expectation that this is going to be an ongoing need. Nitrates in groundwater is not going to be something that's simply addressed. As you know, groundwater has long residence times, and the process of evaluating agricultural practices in any one specific area is going to be an ongoing process. It's going to be an iterative process. So that's what we expect.
Sorry, Representative Hansen.
You'd have to come back to the legislature every 2 years to get continuing funds. If you hire 4.5 permanent positions now with the clean water money, you'd have to come back every 2 years to get additional dollars to fund those positions.
Mr. Stoddard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I think when it comes to clean water legacy funding, most agencies are in the same situation, where we need to launch programs that are going to be sustainable, they're going to be in place, they're not going to be a quick kind of puff and then gone. In order to do that, you have to have staff who are trained and competent and come up to speed. So I think the answer is yes.
Are there any other questions for Representative Junkie or Mr. Stoddard right now? Is there any testimony from the audience? Anybody would like to talk about House File 2301? All right. Representative Jumpy, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We are going to skip down on our agenda to a discussion of the Emerald Ash Borer. We have a report from a meeting yesterday with federal authorities, representative of the Department of Agriculture and Department of Natural Resources. I understand we have Ms. Martinson, Mr. Phillips, let's see, Jim Beerboom, is that right?
Beerboom,
sorry. And Gear Friso. With some of our representatives here. All right. Oh. There we go. And everybody, welcome to the committee. And please introduce yourselves and give us your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jim Borboom, Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. With me today is, from our agency, is Geir Friso, the Director of our Plant Protection Division. I'm here just to give you a brief highlight of some of our agency activities in response to Emerald Ash Borer, and then I'll turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Lori Martinson from the Department of Natural Resources to talk about their work activities. The responsibility of our agency at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is to exclude and prevent the establishment of exotic or invasive pests into Minnesota. Some of the work to date by our agency in exclusion of the Emerald Ash Borer is the fact that we've carried out some trapping and surveillance programs since 2005. Our agency has been part of an interagency task force working with other agencies and private partners that wrote an Emerald Ash Borer response plan. And there are components of that response plan that we're able to utilize or roll out today. Some of the action items that we've implemented in response to the recent detection of Emerald Ash Borer in Victory, Wisconsin, is that we've met with our federal partners to enhance our surveillance efforts. We've met, our staff in our agency have met with Houston County Commissioners to answer questions regarding this pest. Our nursery staff is called on nursery owners in southeast Minnesota to alert them of the findings of this Emerald Ash Borer and to discuss the impacts of this pest to their operations. And we formed an incident command team consisting of members from our agency, members of the Department of Natural Resources, and our federal partners. We're also working on developing a quarantine of Houston County that prohibits the movement of ash material out of that county. Some of the work plans that we intend to do on a short-term basis is that we'll continue to conduct some additional assessments of three counties in southeast Minnesota. We'll work with the media and others to raise public awareness and outreach to limit the movement of ash firewood. We're working with the Department of Commerce to enforce state firewood label laws. What that would mean is to ensure that firewood coming from out of state could be quickly identified as possibly being coming from a known infected area. And finally, we're expanding an early detector network. We're doing that in cooperation with the University of Minnesota and the Department of Natural Resources. And I'll have Hillary Martinson talk about more of their work.
Before we get to you, Representative Davis has a question for Mr. Borbom.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Borbom, you mentioned three counties. Would that be Houston, Fillmore, and Winona?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davis, that's correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you again, Mr. Borbom. Commissioner Martinson. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Wagini, if you have a question for Mr. Borbom.
I did. You were mentioning label laws to make sure that firewood wasn't coming in from prohibited areas. Are we strictly banning firewood from areas that have had emerald ash borer?
Mr. Bobo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, the answer to that is yes, that I would have to defer to our Plant Protection Director, Gary Friesel, to talk more about how we implement that, but the answer is yes.
So,
Representative Wagenius.
But just one follow-up, actually. Mm-hmm. If somebody brought in firewood from an area that had emerald ash borer, they would be breaking the law.
Mr. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, again, I probably have to defer to Gear Friesel.
Let's bring him down.
To answer Friesel. The question.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, my name is Gear Friesel. I'm the director of the Plant Protection and Minnesota Department of Agriculture. As to your question, any firewood that comes out of, if there's a federal quarantine in place for those states or counties that are quarantined, it is illegal to move that material out of those areas without a compliance agreement. So it would be a violation of federal law, and we could also take action if the firewood was not meet one of three treatments, which are either debarking, fumigation, or kiln drying.
If I could,
Representative Wagenius.
Then that begs the question, is the federal quarantine law good enough to protect Minnesotans from getting firewood from areas that have had emerald ash borer?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, members, that's a difficult question to answer. I think the quarantine is a very good job with those commercial pathways. What is difficult is just public citizens and making sure that they are aware of the quarantine and the need to avoid moving firewood. So that's the challenge. There was legislation passed last year that requires labeling of firewood, and that has been of enormous help because it says that firewood that comes from out of state needs to identify the county of origin. And that has given us a great foothold to identify potentially firewood that may be of risk and that we would look at further.
But Representative Wagenius?
I think the assurance I am looking for is, because, I mean, we all do not want firewood from any place that has emerald ash borer. So the assurance I'm looking for are the rules in place, and if it's on the federal level, so be it, are the rules in place to make sure that any commercial outfit would not bring in wood to this state from those areas.
Mr. Frigo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, there is rules in place to prevent the movement of firewood out of those areas, and the department does conduct inspections and oversees that those firewood that is sold in Minnesota is meeting those federal requirements.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Frito, I want to kind of follow up on that question relating to authority and compliance and enforcement. So if it's a federal compliance requirement, does the Department of Agriculture have the authority to act through a delegated agreement for, say, a stop order or administrative penalty? Or is it something that has to go to a U.S. attorney for criminal? I mean, where? How much authority do you have? Do you have it through a federal agreement, or do you have to gather information and refer to the federal authorities in order for them to act, and then they have to act through the federal system?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, either agency could take action. Generally, if it's an interstate violation, we often defer to USDA APHIS to take the action. They have a very robust laws. Minnesota does also, we have the ability to take a state action if needed, if it's a deliberate introduction of an exotic or invasive plant pest under the Minnesota statutes, we could also take action. But there is not actual delegated authority similar to what is in a pesticide law, for example.
Representative Lothar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I think, like all enforcement actions, it's really dependent upon voluntary compliance, and occasionally, you know, one becomes aware of violations and then you have to respond to those. But I do think I was really caught off guard when there was a couple of potential retail introductions of emerald ash borer into our state within the last year and a half. And the first one happened right about Arbor Day a year ago, in which it was determined that Menards stores had accepted non-debarked ash wood from states in which there was a quarantine. And then I saw a later order related to Lowe's with some planters that were constructed out of wood with bark on from quarantine areas. And that to me really says that we have significant risk of not only introduction by people carrying firewood from state to state or from an infected area to another infected area, but also because our retail and commercial business oversight is limited. I think governmental overseers have been cut back at all levels, and so I think we have some risk that way. But the other new area that hasn't really gotten as much attention is the whole biofuel area, in which we are increasingly building power plants to use waste wood and other products as fuel. And could you address that, Mr. Friso, in terms of plans or our needs for planning to deal with that as a potential movement of infected firewood as well?
Mr. Friso.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lawfer, we have so far focused our attention on pathways such as firewood commercial movement, nursery stock, unprocessed timber. So those are the areas that we're really focusing our attention on. If there is biofuels that are coming from a quarantined area, that would still have to, if there's ash wood in that material, they would also have to meet those federal requirements, and they would be subject to both federal and state regulations.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lawson.
And I really appreciate the fact that we're really starting now to ramp up our first detector network so that we're more likely to catch outbreaks. I mean, the stand that was found by Victory, they estimate, has been there 5 to 10 years. And most outbreaks are found by the public, not by professionally trained foresters. So my concern is about areas that we have not yet identified that may be infected currently, and the movement from within those areas. I do believe that you have, you know, detailed plans for how to regulate things within a quarantine area. But are there plans yet on the ground to do training for people who might be involved with the biofuels industry, with other tree handling and forest product handling businesses within Minnesota, in addition to the first responders and the public?
Mr. Friesel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lawford, right now, because we are unaware that there is any biofuels coming out of those quarantine areas, to be honest, we have not been any planning specific for that potential movement of wood. As I said, we've really focused on those pathways that we're aware of ash. But certainly, if there was ash material coming from for biofuels out of an infested area, we would certainly provide oversight.
Commissioner Martinson, do you have a friend coming up to help?
Mr. Chair, I do. This is Olin Phillips. He's the section manager for our Forest Protection Management Program.
Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lawler, we do have things in place that would work with biomass as we start to go towards the future in this emerging market. We're very aware of the potential threats that could be posed from the movement of biomass into the bay from infested areas. It would, as Mr. Friesel has pointed out, still fall under their quarantine capabilities to enforce. Fortunately, most of the biomass movement that would come into the state would probably be in a chip form, which would greatly reduce the potential. And if they're bringing in large logs or intact woody material for biomass, it would be a different situation. One of the goals we have right now is to start to expand our agency capabilities and work with the Department of Transportation on their way stations as materials are coming into the state, the ability for them to identify ash wood as well as potential infested ash wood that would be moving into the state, and kind of a heightened example too as we pull together the different capabilities that exist within our state agencies to do this in-kind support of the effort within the last four.
Representative Loffler?
Thank you. And in terms of the movement of firewood, I know we have a law that deals with the movement of firewood into our state campgrounds and forests, but is there a specific law that allows you to prohibit the movement of firewood or infected wood, and what are the penalties and how would they be applied?
Mr. Friesel?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loffler, there, if the wood is known to be infested, the department could take action to prevent the movement of it, and we could. There are penalties that we could propose. So far, we haven't run into that situation. There is no specific exterior quarantine in Minnesota, I guess, so we're relying on the federal quarantine.
Does the DNR have anything to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, Austin Loeffler, we do have a commissioner's order in place to restrict the movement of firewood into state lands that are managed by the Department of Natural Resources. We're currently updating that commissioner's order. It was put in place 2 years ago and refining a little bit, but it will restrict the movement of any ash firewood into our state park system or our campground system within the state. Our goal is also to work with the private campgrounds across the state to start to adopt similar restrictions on the movement of wood into their lands as well. And that would be on a voluntary basis.
Representative Lawford.
Well, Mr. Chair and Chair Guest, I know we're ramping up as quick as we can in many ways, but I am concerned that we're not prepared to deal with how big a threat this is. On my block alone, I think there must be about 7 chimeneas or backyard firewood burners, and those are clearly not on state lands and they're not in private campgrounds. And I think it's the demand for that that led one of our major retailers to accept wood that was from a quarantine area into its retail stores. And so I do think that we have to protect this out. And it's not, this one is not going to be inexpensive. For cities that have, you know, 20 to 50% of their tree cover and canopy in ash, it was the most popular tree to replace elm. And we have maps that the Department of Agriculture has put together in partnership with the Department of Natural Resources. It shows across Minnesota the communities that are heavily dependent upon this as the dominant tree. We could turn into a very different place in terms of many of our communities as well as many of our outdoor areas. I've seen pictures of cities in that were old established cities with beautiful tree cover, and you see the after picture and it looks like a brand new suburban development on a previously plowed field. And that's not, I think, what Minnesotans want to see in the future. And so I'm concerned about introduction not only into our campgrounds and our state forests and our state parks, but also into the neighborhoods throughout the state of Minnesota, because that will give us a very different feel. And it will be also very expensive to our municipalities, not only in terms of taking down the trees, but dealing with the environmental impacts. One city reported that its water usage went up 30% just because it had lost the shade that was provided to the yards and gardens of that community. And we already, in the bills before this committee, are struggling with how to help our rural communities deal with increased capacity in their wastewater treatment and water plants. So I think it's going to have a multiple impact if we lose control at any point in this process. And so I'm hoping that we will, you know, have an inventory before we're done with the session of laws and regulations that we need to assist you in creating that stronger network of early detectors and also the response tools that you need to make sure this doesn't spread.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I'd like to thank Representative Loeffler for her work on this issue. It really wasn't on my radar screen until it was across the Little River. So that developed House File 2338. But again, I'd like to thank Representative Loeffler for your lead on this issue and bringing it to the forefront. I've got a series of questions here. The first question is, has any emerald ash borer been found in Minnesota to this point that we're aware of?
Mr. Friedman.
Chair, Representative David, no, there's not been any emerald ash borer found. And I should mention, I do have some samples that's of interest to the committee that I could pass around if you'd like to see actual emerald ash borer. Should I pass those on?
That'd be great.
So now we're invested in this room.
And then here's a picture of the actual ash tree in Victory that's infested, so you can see what the damage is, and then also some of the maps of
now. Representative Davis, I believe Mr. Borbon or someone mentioned that Houston County has been quarantined. Is that correct?
Mr. Friedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative David, we are proposing quarantine Houston County, and that will likely happen today.
Okay.
Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Friedo, I'm kind of confused. We don't have any here, but yet we're quarantining someplace. Don't you usually quarantine a place that has something?
Mr. Friedo.
Mr. Chair, Representative David, that's correct. I would point out, first off, that in Wisconsin, the county of Crawford, which is not known to be, which is adjoining the infestation, was also quarantined by both the state of Wisconsin and the federal. We believe, because of the close proximity, that it's prudent to quarantine Houston County. Emerald ash borer moves about 2 miles a year naturally. And if you look at that picture of that tree, you can see that it's very damaged. So it's probably been an infestation that's been in place for 5 to 10 years. And one of those maps I passed out shows the percentage of ash trees in the river there. So there is a very a high host population in that area that creates a very a good bridge to Minnesota. So just biologically, we believe emerald ash borer is in Minnesota. We have not found it, and so we just think the prudent thing to do is to make sure it's precautionary to make sure no ash wood moves out of Houston County to protect the rest of the state, and we think that's the best course of action for Minnesota.
Representative Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of my concerns is Representative Loeffler's concern. I can see how you can regulate the commercial firewood companies going into the motor marts or the state parks or campgrounds or wherever. I've got two concerns. One concern is you've got Ranger Rick and his family in Wisconsin in a quarantined county are going on vacation to beautiful southeast Minnesota. They throw a few pieces of ash firewood in the back of their camper and head out. And go. How do we stop that?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, that you're very correct. That is one of the most difficult, and that's where I think the whole public outreach, public education needs to be increased. And I think, you know, DNR has been very successful in getting people to understand that when they move boats from lake to lake, that they need to take some self-responsibility. And I think most people, if they're informed and know that there's a risk by moving firewood, that most people will try and do the responsible thing. And so I think we need to, the only way to deal with that is by voluntary compliance. We'll never be able to hire enough inspectors or enforcers to go out and check people's trunks for firewood. So we need to rely on people's understanding of the risk and their willingness to do the right thing.
Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one other potentially cautionary note here is we have a very large community in some of our Houston counties that when we talk about the public outreach, sure, that sounds great and educational, that's wonderful, but we have a very large community in Houston, some of our counties that doesn't have a radio, don't have TVs, don't buy newspapers. How do we get to that community? Because I can see them in Houston County that's quarantined, them chopping up some firewood, putting in their buggy, heading over to Fillmore County, over to Mabel or Harmony or Canton, and moving it without even having heard that there's a problem. So when you think about, I guess it's more of a statement, when you think about outreach, we have to figure out a way to get to some folks that we can't get to by normal means.
Please,
Madam Chair, Representative Davis, you're correct, and it is going to require some creativity on our part. We have met with the county commissioners. We think by working with local units of government and seeking their assistance to contact those sorts of folks and doing whatever creative things, whether it be maybe something through hunting licenses, there's a lot of things, possibilities, that we will certainly explore those to the best of our ability to get the word out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Friesel, we've talked a little bit about authorities and responsibilities, but should Minnesota at this time just ban out-of-state importation of that firewood?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen,
please up.
We did investigate that possibility, and there are some legal challenges to doing that. One is there is the federal plant protection has a preemption that prohibits states from implementing quarantines that are the same as a federal one. So in other words, Minnesota couldn't do an emerald ash borer quarantine on its own on firewood. The other, probably the more difficult one though, is the Commerce Clause, and that's really the one that we really ran to. The Attorney General advised us that we would have a very difficult time imposing an exterior quarantine because of the Commerce Clause and preventing movement.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could Minnesota put conditions on any importation of firewood? For example, say that only certified firewood that has been kilned or debarked or whatever, could we do that to protect our resources? Does the state have the authority to do that?
Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, that's a possibility, and we have discussed that a little bit as to whether or not we could require. We were advised, though, that we could still be running against the Commerce Clause because of that, because it still would be perceived as impeding movement of firewood. So right now, it has to come out of the quarantine areas before we can take a regulatory action.
Representative Hansen.
And then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Friso, finally, on in a few hours here, we're going to be taking up the Ag and Veterans budget and our budget cuts that are in there. And how are you going to pay? How is the department or departments going to pay for existing reaction or response to this from your budgets, and how do you compensate for the dollars that are going to be spent in reacting to this?
Mr. Friso.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, we have reprioritized some of our staff to focus right now our attention on this situation. We are working very closely with USDA AFIS that does provide funding for a variety of our programs. We already have AFIS funds a statewide Emerald Ash Borer trapping program, so we put out about 1,000 of those traps, and then we also get received funding from U.S. Forest Service. With this discovery and victory, it is our understanding that we will get significantly increased funding from USDA. I don't know the exact figure. We have worked up some proposals of the kinds of staffing that we would like to have to react, respond to the situation, and that's it.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Friso. I have heard from a variety of people who've been involved in this, and you yourself said that you believe it is in Minnesota. We just haven't found it yet. And I think there's many people who are concerned about our trees who suspect it may be in other parts of the state. It just hasn't been detected because, quite honestly, our eyes on the trees are pretty limited, and they're much more limited than they used to be because many cities, because of the financial stresses that they're under, have not been able to maintain professional foresters. The public works person that they sent through tree care training in the past may have been laid off or has been reassigned to other responsibilities. And so can you talk to us a little bit about the current staffing abilities within the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Natural Resources? I know you've been doing a really nice team effort of pulling resources from both because neither one has sufficient resources. But if we were to have those recently trained first detectors and the extra publicity now get a number of reported outbreaks and say by the end of June we have 4 spots that have been confirmed in Minnesota, what it would be our capabilities of being able to quickly respond and establish quarantines, get the word out, and you know, in the past, in the current, I continue to seek us having adequate resources so that we can respond, because it usually, I'm surprised, this time it happened while we were in the legislative session, but usually surprises happen when we're not.
Friso.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I've passed around a couple of maps that show some of the trapping that we're doing. We are both trap trees and sticky traps. Unfortunately, both those detection methods are very poor in comparison to other invasive pests such as gypsy moth, where we have some very good detection tools. So you're correct, Representative Loeffler, that it's really the public and those and the people who are aware of EAB. Most of the detections in this, and even the site in Victory, Wisconsin, was found by a citizen, not by a detection tree or a trap. We have been, and together with the Department of Natural Resources, have been working very closely with the university, Dean Hertzfeld, who has been working with a early detector network that came out of the soybean rust situation from a few years ago. And they have trained right now several hundred early detectors, and we have a process in place for people to report suspicions of emerald ash borer, and some sort of citizen scientists that can do the initial response to potential infestations, and then would allow either Department of Ag or the Department of Natural Resources to follow up. So we are actively working to get as many eyes out there to look for the insect. We've also been working with our county ag inspectors and also some of the local tree inspectors.
Mr. Members, from a DNR standpoint, as many of you know, we have field staff throughout the state. What we're planning on doing is this year, by July 1st, training all of our field staff in the southeastern part of the state on how to identify the pest and how to identify presence in ash trees. And they all live in cities and they all live in their communities, so even when they're out on natural landscapes and then when they're in town, that's an additional force. And then throughout this year, we will be training all of our field staff statewide. So we'll be expanding that detection network by having all of our staff trained. We're also looking at a meeting with all of the land managers in the state. So that would be all of the county land commissioners, St. Louis County, Lake County, where we have large amounts of public lands, and then additionally meeting with the U.S. Forest Service, the Chippewa and the Superior, meeting with the National Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and together putting together an army of trained people who know what to do, and that we're coordinating our management plans for detection and awareness and trying to slow the movement of any pests when they occur. So we're trying to put some pieces in place that we think we can do within our existing resources and begin to prepare for this pest coming to Minnesota.
Representative Murphy has been looking at the map, and I think she has a question from the map.
I think that the spot in Wisconsin, this white spot in Wisconsin, maybe came from here, but how did it come from here to there without being here?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, when you see those long-distance jumps like that, it's almost sure thing that that was human activity that brought that. Whether nobody knows for sure if it was firewood or nursery stock or some other contaminated material, but it is certainly not a natural movement. Just to go from the east side of Wisconsin to the west side of Wisconsin or even down into Missouri, those are a very large jump, those are the sorts of things from a regulatory perspective we would focus our attention on to try and prevent that from occurring in Minnesota.
Okay. And then one more
Representative
question.
Representative Murphy.
One more question about this picture with the tree. You know, I have a tamarack tree that was about 7 years old, and it looks just like this, except that I thought it was because the deer's ran their antlers or their heads against it, and that's what it looks like now. But could it be?
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I would be skeptical, but I would not rule it out until we actually saw it. There are a number of bark beetles and insects that feed in the phloem of trees that cause that kind of damage, and of course deer can cause damage. Some of the characteristics of emerald ash borer, the bark I passed around is a very distinctive D-shaped exit hole, and also the galleries is a very serpentine S shape underneath the bark, and those are probably two of the key characteristics. But there are a number of other native bark beetles that can cause damage.
Skills that I'm learning this morning, and I'm going to inspect that tree when I get home on or Saturday.
And she's even going to do it for free.
Mr.
Phillips, do you have something to add to that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, tamarack often has that due to the bark beetles that Mr. Friesel talks about, and what happens is then the woodpeckers come seeking those insects, and they take off that external bark. And actually, it's a very similar woodpecker activity. It's a strong issue related to the emerald ash borer also, as they hone in on those larvae that are underneath the bark. And so it's not the same insect on your tamarack, but it is showing the same kind of exfoliation by the woodpeckers looking for the insect.
And it's likely that the tree is dying and now too.
Mr. Phillips?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, not always, but if it's pretty broadly over the whole tree, it's probably a good indication that it's in poor health.
Thanks.
Representative Wagenia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the federal law and the possible preemption of our doing more, because, I mean, all of us have heard how much it's going to cost us if this gets a foothold in Minnesota. So we're all concerned. You said there might be a federal preemption, or there appears to be a federal preemption. Sometimes those federal preemptions are not total and have room for states to move. I would ask our council if they would look at this issue, particularly when the assertion is made that the Commerce Clause is preventing us from doing anything here, because that just doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever. The Commerce Clause has an exception, and the exception is huge, and in this problem fits the exception to a T. So if our council could maybe look at this issue and make sure that I want to make sure that we are doing everything legally we can do to keep this Empalachicoor out of the state.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to Mr. Friesel. Okay, down the road here, you go to Reno, Minnesota, in Houston County, and we find it, or Brownsville, or wherever along the river there. What do you do? How do you stop it? How do you eradicate it? What do you do to it? I mean, do you fumigate it? Do you spray it? What do we do to stop it in its tracks so it doesn't spread to Caledonia and Preston and Austin and Albert Lee?
Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative David, I'm afraid you may not like my answer very well. In other states where there have been aggressive efforts to eradicate by removing ash trees, Michigan, for example, spent over $50 million, and they were unsuccessful. There's only two known successful eradications of emerald ash borer, and those both involved a very small infestation and also very recent and young, less than 2 years old. The problem is the difficulty of knowing how far out the emerald ash borer is and the poor quality of detection tools that we have available to us. So we would very much be relying simply on identifying as well as we can the size of the infestation and then making sure nothing moves out of those areas. The longer we can slow it down, the more chance we have for other technologies to catch up with the effort. There are three biological control agents. There are three stingless wasps that have been brought from China, and they show up to a 70% success rate. Their release is probably 4 to 5 years down the road. The longer that we can slow it down or contain it to certain small areas, and Houston County is a relatively low population of ash, so that's a fortunate place if you have to have it. So the longer we can contain it and just keep it there and then allow those biocontrol technologies to come on board, and also there's been a lot of research done on other control mechanisms. There are some injectable treatments for individual trees, although those are quite expensive and labor intensive. But right now, actual removal of trees from an eradication standpoint is a strategy that really has largely been abandoned. There are some strategies. There's a new strategy called slow ash mortality that works to create what they call phloem sinks, where you try to create a situation that draws the beetles into an area or concentrate them, and then treat those concentrated areas or remove and chip those concentrated trees. But it's not an eradication. It's just simply a containment and a management effort.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, Representative Davis, I'm sorry. Mr. Fries, I think you said something there that was very important, though, and clearly you're identifying a value, even if eradication is not a reasonable expectation. Slowing the spread of the emerald ash borer has a high value. Am I correct? Did I hear that?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, and that's the same strategy we've done with gypsy moth. The Department of Agriculture, for 25 years, we've been stomping out gypsy moth pockets in Minnesota, but it will eventually get here, and we'll have to learn to live with it. But the longer we can slow it down, that has a huge economic benefit to doing that. Just from preventing future impacts, and then, again, as I said, allowing research to catch up, because this is such a brand new pest. The researchers have been going to China to try and learn about how to deal with this pest.
Thank you, Mr. Friezo. Representative Davis.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Friezo, you're exactly correct. I don't like your answer.
Representative Rossler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think this is an area where we're really going to have some significant debate and really talk about the scientific evidence as well as the impacts on Minnesota. And we have had more success than any other state on gypsy moth, and we ought to be proud of that. In part, it's been because we have gotten special federal grants that have enabled us to have a very mobile, very well-trained group of people who can respond quickly to every outbreak. And we have had more success than any other state in the nation, I understand, Mr. Friezo can correct me if I'm wrong, than any other state in the nation. And I'm hoping that as the state with the highest concentration of ash in the nation, that we will also be a nation leader in responding to this. And we have both state and federal budget pressures that I think are pushing this go-slow approach. The federal government has expended a lot of money in other states, and because of their federal situations and a new administration, I don't think has actually even had a chance to even think about this, dealing with other issues. I think we need to really challenge our federal partners to step up in Minnesota like they have in other states. And until they do, I think we need to, because if we don't have eyes on the trees, we can catch those early infestations that have shown success that Mr. Friezo mentioned, which is when you see them when the trees are in their first year or two of an infestation. But you're only going to be able to do that if you have eyes on the trees statewide, and we can catch it when it's isolated because someone brought in the wrong firewood for their backyard fire pit. And somebody's alert in the neighborhood or in the town staff saw it, and we respond quickly. And that's going to take resources. We do not it's going to take a lot of dedicated volunteers. We have an incredible group of tree huggers and tree lovers throughout the state of Minnesota who I think will respond. But I think we also need to look at the investments we're making right now with the stimulus funds, with youth employment programs, people who are going to be out working in our parks and our natural areas this summer, and seeing that all of them are trained. I think the plan to ramp up the first detector training is too slow. There's, I think, 4 trainings planned a year. We mentioned how they were going to train the DNR field staff in southeast Minnesota. I think if you look at the map of the risk, and it's been circulating around, the introduction risk is the highest in the metro area, and then it's basically our lakes area. And nothing is going to break someone's heart more than if they lose the trees around their lake property, or a resort owner loses the trees and all of a sudden their little resort on the lake becomes a little resort on the prairie alongside a body of water. And I think that that's going to have devastating impacts on our economy. And so it's, I think, in our state's best interest, more than some states, because we have an $8 billion woods industry, we have a huge multi-billion dollar tourist industry, and we have an environment that we care about, that I think early detection and immediate response, and I'm concerned because we don't have the immediate response teams, and we don't have the resources for our local governments to pick this up. And if you went with the go slow approach, you're gonna, and which the acronym is SLAM, it feels like to me like we're gonna slam local budgets, because if we let those trees die, they are still going to have to be taken down and moved. They're going to be a safety hazard in a developed area. They're going to be a hazard for further infestation if they're in a rural area, because you're going to have somebody who's going to go around and say, hey, I see that dead firewood out in your back 40. Could I take that out for you? And we don't know. And the person who says, hey, yeah, you're going to clean that up, it's going to be better deer habitat to get some new fresh growth, they're not going to worry necessarily about where that wood's going and who it's going to be sold to. And it could be sold in my neighborhood with someone who's knocking on the doors in the fall at every house that they see that has a fireplace and saying, hey, I've got some firewood, and offering it at a cheap price, and all of a sudden you've infected another neighborhood, another part of the state. And so I think to do this, I have a public health background. You actually deal with it like you're planning an infectious disease outbreak. I mean, it's the same thing. You have to alert the public. You have to make sure that that, you know, you identify it quickly, that you get the resources in to respond right away. And I'm not sure we have yet built or funded the system, even though I think every single one of our professionals in the state agencies have been doing their best. They just, there aren't enough of them, and there aren't enough emergency response resources. And so I hope that we're going to spend some time talking about how do we do that, because if we don't catch things early and respond quickly, then it will be like a wildfire in slow motion. We looked at the GAO study of 6 states that lost control of 3 disease pests. And they, because there's states that have been successful and states that have spent millions and millions of dollars not being successful. The states that were unsuccessful, one, they didn't have enough eyes on the trees, so it wasn't being detected or caught until it was really well established. Number two, they did not have the clear authorities and responsibilities defined in law and between the state agencies and local agencies in terms of who was in charge of what. And three, they didn't have the emergency response money to deal with it quickly so that they could respond to outbreaks as it came along. And I think we can learn from the mistakes of others. We do not want to be a Michigan that invests tens of millions of dollars and feels like it hasn't been able to encircle the spreading outbreak. But I'm hoping that we can be a successful model, as we have been in Gypsy Moth, of responding appropriately, quickly, and effectively with the resources that are available to us.
Members, Commissioner Martinson has been very, very patient while the Department of Agriculture seems to have sucked most of the oxygen out of the room. And I think Representative Davids has a quick question. And I have a question for Mr. Borboom, and then Commissioner Martinson, we know you've come here probably with something very important to say from the DNR on this, and then we want to give you a chance, and then maybe members have some questions for you as well. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I need Mr. Friesel back here for a second, if I could. Two parts to my question. Who put on the quarantine? Do you say it was a federal quarantine, and the state's going to enact it also today, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, I'll try and stop sucking the air out of the room, but
you've done it very well.
The state will initially implement a county quarantine, and then the USDA will follow up immediately with a parallel quarantine.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman and Mr. Friesel, the wood industry is very important in southeastern Minnesota, usually hardwoods and so forth, and whether you have oak or elm or maple or whatever the hardwood is. Is elm a hardwood?
Yeah,
elm, okay. So you got the hardwood industry down there, and they're slowing down right now because of the building trades are down, and so they, you know, it's just not going like it was. But if we have a quarantine county like Houston, which has a large wood industry, the quarantine is on ash only, so they're okay to harvest their oak and their whatever else they're harvesting.
Mr. Friesel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davis, that's correct. It would only affect ash species, and I don't believe ash is used in the mills down there. I don't know if Holden knows that. Or
Mr. Chairman, sure. Representative Davis, they do use ash. You know, they'll use almost any wood that they can come across and process. Most of that, because it ends up being a sawn product, is free of bark and is then able to move outside of the county. And so even the ash, if it was processed, would meet the standard for movement outside of the county with an agreement with the Department of Agriculture.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Commissioner Borboom, we've heard Mr. Friedo say that there is value in slowing the spread of the emerald ash borer, even if we are unable to eradicate it. I guess my question to you,